Dixie back to Dixieland.
Hello, listeners. Welcome once again to the Benny South Street Chronicles. I'm joined today by a fellow podcaster, as well as a very successful and popular stand-up comedian. You'll recognize her from her Comedy Central Presents. She has also appeared on Last Comic Standing. And her album, It's Never Going to Be Bread, hit Amazon.com's top 10 comedy albums for the year 2010. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Yes, and you'll recognize her voice, of course. It's Hello. Jackie Cation.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for coming to my apartment and sitting down and speaking with me.
I love Northridge. Oh. Who doesn't?
It's a great part of town, isn't it?
It's lovely. You got sea sun, you got things are happening.
Exactly. And you know, there's so much within walking distance, too.
Is it?
It's very
good. It does seem pretty nice as far as, like, I mean, granted, you'd have to eat it at Chili's, too.
Oh, yeah.
But I did stop at the Subway before I came over.
There's a Subway, there's a Ross, there's a McDonald's, Vons is right there.
I like to eat fresh.
Yes.
I don't mind eating fresh sometimes.
I'm in favor of that as well.
I go in cycles about eating fresh. Sometimes I'm over it. And even the smell of their bread will drive me, away.
Yeah.
But now, I'm in a good space.
Well, that's good. That's what I encourage. I like people to be in that mindset when they come to the show. So, normally, my podcast, it's about, like, theatrical performance, but I vary it for people who I think might have an interesting insight. You're a stand-up comedian.
Right.
How long have you been doing it?
Probably full-time since 93, but there was, like, 8 years before that where I did open mics and I worked, sort of just weekendy rooms. And I had to reboot. Like, I started in 1986 and in Madison, Wisconsin, at a little club that is no longer there, underneath a Coke den and an other crime-laden moment.
Now, well, because when you think gritty living, you think Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, when you think of it, you think, let's talk about that while we wear our beret and go buy coffee with traveler's checks in 1986. And so, yeah, and then I moved to Minneapolis in 90. And so I sort of rebooted in 90. So probably since 90, though over 20 years, I guess. Mm. So it's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm curious, though, as to, you know, what was the thing that made you go up the first time? Like, what was there something that made you say, I have to do comedy or I'm eager to try it?
You know, it's weird about performance, because I always wanted to act and I always wanted to perform and stuff when I was a kid. And then I had never watched stand-up comedy. I'd never seen it. I think I saw Gallagher on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. And I saw a show that they did a recap of, I think, in the 90s called Make Me Laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And with Gallagher again. And I was like, I love this guy. and even though I knew it wasn't fair, because when you see Gallagher on The Tonight Show, you probably find the clip on YouTube, is he was on with a giant couch behind him.
Mm-hmm.
That's not fair. Who's not going to laugh at a giant couch? That's not good writing, as
well,
we say.
Yeah.
That's just a giant fucking couch.
Yeah.
Can you swear?
Well, how do you, please.
Cuss it up?
The explicit tag is in effect.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the story is told so many times, and it's a good one, so I understand why people want to hear it, but I got very, very drunk and the first time I saw stand-up comedy, and I saw Sam Kinison,
oh,
who is a yeller.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a bad set because he was a mess of a human being. And so his sets were hit and miss, you know. And he was playing this stupid club in Madison that his brother owned.
Mm.
And so he was probably phoning it in anyway. But anyway, so I was sitting in the front row. I had had probably 6 or 7 shots of tequila.
Oof.
And I just started, I heckled him. And he did a good job mopping up the floor with me. Mm. But I wouldn't shut up. I am essentially it's a karmic moment whenever I get the drunk woman comic, the drunk woman heckler, which is the worst heckler, because you can't. Yeah, there's even as a woman, to be mean to a woman who's in the audience, is you get very little support.
Mm.
It's not working. So that's what happened with Sam Kinison, is he got very little support. And so it continued much longer than it should have. And then the manager came over and told me sarcastically that open mic was on Sundays. And so about a month later, 3 weeks later, I came back and did stand-up. And there was no one doing it. You know, there was one club. It was open 7 nights a week for no reason. And so I got to go up like 6 or 7 nights a week for 5 to 10 minute sets for 8 months.
Nice.
And Sam Kinison's brother, Bill Kinison, still alive, still with us, would pay us, or me anyway, $10 a week. And I got a 1.8 that semester. And I...
So you were in college?
Oh, yeah. I was in college at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And then he... And when he would pay us and we would bitch about the money, he'd be like, one day you'll thank me. You'll thank me for this for this time when you get to go up this much. And he's right. I mean, 8 months. The club burned down. Thank God it was insured. But the club burned down, so I got 8 months of almost constant stand-up comedy. Which is what you have to do. That's what stand-up comedy is. I mean, I'm sure it's true with acting or plumbing or, I don't know, any other gig. I mean, if you do it all the time, you'll get better at it.
So then... you were in college. Did you have like another career plan in mind? Were you studying something specific or?
Oh no. I I went to college. There was some thought of being a lawyer at some point. There was some thought of I wanted to be a teacher. I studied poli sci, so I like the idea of kind of being a social studies teacher, and but they were just sort of I don't know what I want to do kind of thing. I mean, for a long time, I wanted to be a forest ranger. So, you know, I've always been 11. And so I want to be a teacher. I want to be a forest ranger. And I want to be a lawyer or a doctor. But then, you know, I almost studied classics. Mm-hmm. Because I took Latin, and I love Roman history and all this stuff. And then I realized I was going to have to start with ancient Greek. And it's really hard. So I was like, no. Yeah. That was an idea.
So I want to go back just a little bit.
Sure.
The night that you saw Sam Kinison,
mm-hmm.
you said, was that the first time you'd seen stand-up comedy live?
Yes.
Do you remember why you decided to go into a comedy club that night? Like, did someone invite you?
Well, remember, this is back in the 12th century when the drinking age was 18.
Oh.
So I was 18, and I think I went... I think I went with Karen and Stan. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Karen, Stan, if you're out there, email me, Jackie@JackieCation.com. Anyway, so we just went to the, they were like, hey, there's a new comedy club.
Oh, okay. So it was just something to do. It wasn't like, hey, I gotta go see comedy.
I'm the worst, yeah. I am essentially a walking caricature of what terrible comedy clubs are full of. Which are people that are like, I don't know what we're going to see. What are we going to see? Oh, comedy? Okay, what's it going to be like? I don't know. It should
be comedy. I like to laugh.
Yeah, I like to laugh. I like, you know, so you go and then you see Sam Kinison.
Right.
Well, Sam Kinison is a very specific kind of stand-up comedy. It's like saying, let's go see comedy. Who should we go see? Well, you have a choice between... who's...
Lewis Black and Bill Engvall.
Right. Like, or Norton. Like, all of a sudden, Jim Norton's in the mix. Like, it could be Kermit Apio, who's a Hawaiian, super clean, really smart, really funny comic. And there's Jim Norton, who's super dirty, very smart, very funny comic. But, you know, entirely different experiences about to be had.
Like, oh, this place has live music. I like music. Let's go in there.
Right. And then if it isn't reggae,
yeah.
you're disappointed. You're like, damn it, yeah. I wanted reggae.
So then, were you interested in performing as a child? Like, had you done any children's theater or, like, school plays?
We did a lot of, like, the kids in my neighborhood. It was a Norman Rockwell upbringing, except for the beatings.
Ooh.
And, no, I can't. And so with the, because I always thought that the Norman Rockwell upbringing included beating. Don't you think?
It probably did,
yeah. I mean, look at those people.
Yeah.
Those are some angry, angry people that are hiding some rage.
Exactly.
Anyway, so...
That kid sitting next to the cop at the lunch counter, he's running away for a reason.
Right. He doesn't want to be noticed by the cop any more than we do.
Exactly.
Okay, so, when I was a kid, I did... our neighborhood would put up plays and stuff, and we'd do shows, and the other kids would come and see them, and I don't even remember what I think I was in the band, because my sister played the violin and she played it very well. And then we would put on like little sketches and stuff. And so that was the kind of stuff I did in grade school. And then in high school, there was the high school. I was in band all mm-hmm. the time. I was in marching band and concert band and other dorky band related items. And then I was in, you know, I was in one play in high school, mm-hmm. and my sister, the teacher, we had a bad Thursday, so mm-hmm. the teacher kept everybody, the director of the play, kept everybody after to do a rehearsal after the performance.
Oh.
And kept us for hours, and none of us got home. It was a Thursday night. None of us got home till like 1 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people's parents were like, well, you don't have to go to school on Friday, because you're super tired. And and my parents were like, no, you're gone. And so I went, and my sister was like, you should start a petition and say that that wasn't cool of Miss Kulikowski to do that. And so...
I don't think you can say Kulikowski on that.
Miss K? And the funny thing about Miss Kulikowski is that she was also the choreographer for the Polish Krakow Dancers.
Oh, really?
In Milwaukee. Yes, a professional Krakow dancer.
Nice.
of Polish ancestry, Polish mm-hmm. descent. And so all of the choreography for all of the musicals was like the Polish Krakow Dancers. It was hilarious.
The King and I doing the Polka.
Little Drum Song. Flower Drum Song. We did Flower Drum Song with the Polish Krakow Dancers. It was Oklahoma, all of it. It was, everything was MAME. We did MAME. And Miss K was, quite honestly, a great lady.
Yeah.
A great lady and really, really supportive. And I started this thing, and she never had me in another play, because I was a troublemaker. And so, much like the 50s when they were blacklisted, I was blacklisted. But it was fine. I went and wrote for the school newspaper and became the editor of that. So, it's all working out.
Yeah.
But my sister, you know, everyone in my family was like student council president. Everyone. Except for my two oldest brothers, which were stoned all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But starting with my brother Scott... Scott, Russ, and Darla were all student council president at some point, and used it for ill-gotten gains, might I add. It was a great way to make money, I'm told.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's interesting.
You wonder how they do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Some skimming off the top. There's some side sales.
Yeah. One of my previous guests was David Bax from Battleship Retention.
Okay.
And he was talking about his high school experience, and he said, if you really want to work it in high school, the two people you get to know are the principal's secretary and the head janitor, because then you can have access to everything.
Right. I knew the janitor.
Yeah.
That's funny that he would say that.
He was a very insightful fellow. Now, do you remember which play this was that you were in, that you had to stay late, or was, like...
It was MAME.
Oh, it was MAME.
I was in MAME.
So you were in a musical.
And, and I had one line.
Really?
Yeah, it was terrible, and I almost flubbed it.
Oh.
So... Yeah, I'm not, my acting experience, what I've noticed about actors, like, I saw the Joan Rivers Piece of Work movie, did you see that?
I have not seen it yet.
If you have access to a Netflix account.
I do.
It's on streaming now.
Oh, good.
So, it's great.
Yeah.
It's a super insightful, and at one point in the movie, Joan Rivers says, I don't think of myself as a comic. I think of myself as an actress portraying a comedian. And I call bullshit on that, because if she were an actress, she would act.
Right.
Because all of the actors that I know are like the comics that I know, in the fact that they act.
Mm.
In any crummy, shitty production, they've become some member of a goofy, you know, local theater. They do student films. They do whatever they do just so that they get to act.
Mm.
That's where that comes from. Joan Rivers goes to the Bronx at 10 o'clock on a Thursday night to perform for 100 people with a stool that's all ripped up.
Yeah.
She's a comic. She would like to get up on stage and tell jokey jokes.
Yeah. I remember when I was in Cleveland, I took classes at the Second City when they had a training center there.
Yeah.
And I was really into Second City for a long time. I was buying the company line all the way. I read these History of the Second City books. And Joan Rivers was involved. Like, she had tried to do improv in Chicago. Uh-huh. And they, like, used her as an example of someone who's very, very funny, but wasn't a good improviser because she was constantly joking. like she would sell out the scene in the favor of a joke, and I remember
so,
thinking.
Because Second City does long form or something like that.
They do long
right?
and short.
Okay, because my greatest, I want to like sketch comedy, and I have seen great sketch comedy, and I've seen great improv, but once each. And like I said, I've been doing it for 25 years, so you'd think I would have seen it more often. And it's too bad, because I took the UCB here. I took their first level 101 improv class.
That was going to be my next question, actually.
Well, I took one of the classes, because I took an acting class series here in L.A. Mm-hmm. That was 5 days a week, 4 hours a day, for 12 weeks. And it was called Actors Boot Camp.
Wow.
And the word boot camp, of course, has been massacred.
Yeah.
But the fact is that it was really cool. Mm-hmm. In the fact that you're in class 5 days a week, 4 hours a day, with the same people. And you get to know them. And I don't hang out with any of them anymore. But I genuinely got to know them. I think some of them became friends with each other, you know. And a lot of the you know, younger actors who had just moved to L.A. and didn't have any friends. That's a great place to meet people, obviously, right?
Yeah.
And the acting was great, because it's a Meisner technique, but they also do some Chekhov, and after 12 weeks, you would... And what I learned in those 12 weeks is acting is hard. acting is really hard. What I learned, and then, so after that, I was so psyched about classes, sort of, right?
Yeah.
That I decided to do the UCB improv class. Mm-hmm. And so I took the improv class, and I learned that I knew that improv was hard. I had played some short form games and stuff, and improv is, and especially short form, it's just riffing, mm-hmm. as far as I can tell. But no one should have to sit through it.
Yeah.
And but this was long form. Uh-huh. And I thought it would help my acting, and I thought it would help, you know, all different kinds of stuff. But it was hard, and it was not something I wanted to continue, quite honestly. So.
Well, let me ask you this then. What motivated your decision to take that acting class in the first place?
I really do want to act. Mm-hmm. I don't... Like I said, I obviously don't want to act as much as I want to do stand-up, because I would act. And I would, you know, I was on LA Casting, and I did a couple of student films, and I did, never got a copy of them. Didn't get a copy of one of them.
Aww.
I was like, all right, so you have your head up your ass too,
yeah.
kid who's learning how to shoot film. And and they were fine.
Yeah.
And it was a learning, but I really liked doing it. It was super fun. And, but I took the acting class because I wanted to learn how to act. And I would love actually to take, and that was boot camp 1 and 2. It was like the first was a 6-week program and the second was a 6-week program. So, I would love to take both of them again, quite honestly, just because I'm sure I've forgotten. It's probably been 2 years too. The funniest thing in that one was one of the teachers was an actress. Who is an actress? Working actress, but also teaches on the side, like everybody here in LA. They have some sort of, you know, unless they make a living somehow, they have a day job of some sort. And so this is her job, is to teach these classes. And she was on Babylon 5, a show I never watched.
Mm.
But very, a lot of dork cred there. Very nerd-tastic. And it was, and she was a great teacher. She was hilarious. Her name is Carrie Dobro.
Okay.
And I can't tell you what character she played, but it's D-R-O-B-R-O, if people want to look her up. Anyway, but she was hilarious in the fact that she would tell you, she was incredibly clear as a teacher. She would tell you exactly what she wanted. You would do it, and either do it well, do it poorly, or completely fail. And if you completely failed, there would be mocking.
Aww.
And which a lot of people don't enjoy in a teacher. I enjoy it. I find it, because that's how I was raised, probably, but I don't mind the mocking. So there was mocking, and what was funny is that I spent 12 weeks with her, probably 2 days a week, taking different classes that she taught. And at the end of it, I asked if she would read my solo show, my one-woman show, and how much she would charge to direct it. Mm-hmm. And she was like, oh, I hate one-person shows. And I was like, okay, so you don't want to? And she said, no, send it to me. It'll take me a couple of weeks, but I'll read it. And I'll tell you if I can direct it or whatever. And so she read it, and the first thing she says when she talks to me, we're talking on the phone, she goes, first of all, I watched some of your stand-up online. You're funny. And I was like, thanks a lot. She goes, no, like really funny. And I was like, the tone of surprise after spending 12 weeks with me is not flattering. Yeah. I was like, obviously acting, learned skill, not going to be great at it in 12 weeks.
Yeah.
But stand-up comedy, 20 years, I better not suck.
Mm-hmm.
We'd all be disappointed if I sucked after 20. So she didn't, we ended up not, you know how like a lot of things get bandied about and then never happen. It would have been great if she would have directed it, but it sort of fell apart. She never really got back to me about how much it would cost, and I never followed up on it. And so that's where we've left that.
Right.
It's a good story.
Yeah, it's something you can, you know, pull out. You used to have a one-woman show written. If any producers out there want to put up Jackie's show.
It's a good show, I'll tell you. It's an hour, and there's a half an hour that's still half written, and I put it up in half hour chunks initially, and then I joined them together. Like the first one was called Salesmen and Thieves, and it was about my dad, my brothers, and my uncles. And the second one was about my mom and my grandmother and my sister, and it was called How Did I Get So Feminine? And I put them together, and all it's under an umbrella project called It's a Terrible Burden Being Right. And the third one is about my siblings, because I have four brothers and a sister, and so I just haven't written enough of it to really put it up.
The material's there.
Oh, the material is there, for crying out loud.
Well, I want to ask you something else then about this. I'm not that familiar with Meisner.
Right.
Do you do much, was there much comedy in the class? Like, was there a lot of, you know?
No. Well, that was the other thing, too, is that I wasn't supposed to be funny. And I was trying to be very serious in learning how to act.
Right.
And so when she did not find me humorous, I was like, yeah, but I'm not trying to be, you know, because I'm a person first. And I can turn it on and off, and it doesn't have to, you know, the hilarity does not have to ensue every moment of every day. That sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
So, Meisner's not, there's comedy there, but Meisner, you're supposed to very much live in the moment and respond to what you're doing.
All right. So what texts were you using in that class? You say it was a lot of Chekhov and...
Well, there was a Meisner text.
Oh, okay.
And then there was, that he wrote himself, and then there was... The Target, the Actor's Target, I think it was called, and it was about sort of reaching. There were only two books that were recommended, and then it was mostly hands on.
I see.
It was like there was a warm up period from like 9 to 10 where you would just do. You would just warm up and do. This reacting thing, wow! I literally should take it again because I can't remember. And then there was like scene study class, and then there was, and the second, Boot Camp 2, is about the business side of it. And there was acting for the camera, and there were scene study stuff, and you were expected to do scenes and stuff. But there was also a class where you would do, where the rest of the class would judge you on first impression. And they'd say, okay, so when the casting director sees you, when an agent sees you or a manager sees you, what do they see? And with me, of course, they see airport cop. They see lady who, PTA mom kind of thing, you know? And so it sort of strips away any sort of illusion that you think you're going to play Juliet well into your 40s, you know? And there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's really... But it was devastating for some of the younger actors who thought, well, but I am 19. I should be able to play Juliet. And you're like... But you're 6 feet tall and you weigh 11 pounds, so you're not going to get cast as Juliet. So,
so I guess when I was asking about text, I was thinking about in terms of the scene study, like what kind of scenes they would have you do.
Oh, well, you could pick.
Oh, okay.
You could pick anything.
And so you didn't pick a Neil Simon or Christopher Durang, something where you would be funny.
A couple of them were chosen that way. I don't know enough about. I mean, you know, did you study theater in college?
Yeah, yeah.
So you probably read a lot of plays.
Yeah.
Nope, I haven't read anything.
Okay.
Best of luck. I've read some Sam Shepard.
Okay. Well, you said you were interested in studying classics. Did you read any Aristophanes or, you know, ancient Greek and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I did read Aristophanes and Ovid and all these different, and Sophocles and all this stuff, but that wasn't, they didn't want to see it.
Oh, right.
They certainly didn't want to see it.
Sure. Did you ever read any Shakespeare?
Not enough. And I did have a Shakespeare dork on my podcast once, and it was fascinating. And I'm reading a comic book series right now that is encouraging me to go back to my Shakespeare. It's called Kill Shakespeare. And it's all, well, it's all the characters from Shakespeare's plays that, and Hamlet is the Shadow King. He's the good guy. And, well, Juliet is the head of the rebel forces, and King Richard is the bad guy. But Hamlet is on a quest to find their god, which is Shakespeare. And Richard is on a quest to find Shakespeare and kill him. And Hamlet wants to find him so that he can change the endings,
right?
I think. And Richard would just like to find him because he really dislikes him.
I used to work at a bookstore, and there was a book that came out that was kind of like that. Like, it was a big Shakespeare mashup. I can't remember the title.
Okay.
But it was like, Hamlet was married to Juliet, and Macbeth was trying to usurp him, and it was all this stuff. So, yeah, sounds similar.
Yeah, that does sound similar. I wonder.
Could be a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. There could be some litigation.
Exactly.
So.
All right. Well, so as far as acting classes go, that's the only formal training you've had.
Yes. Okay. I took an acting class in college, but it was nothing.
Really?
Yeah, it was bad.
All right. So if you were gonna take another class, do you think you'd, because there's different schools of thought, like there's like the method, which is what Brando and those kind of people did, then there's what like Mamet and William H. Macy have this thing. It's very much hit your mark, say your line, get off the stage kind of acting. Do you have, like, you enjoyed what you were learning?
Yeah, I did enjoy what I was learning. I have heard about that William H. Macy. The kid I used to babysit for is taking is in that school.
Okay.
In New York. And that kind of fascinates me a little bit. That interests me somewhat. Because I like the idea of just sort of doing it.
Right.
I don't mind, you know, like there's a mystique to acting that I don't feel in stand-up comedy. Like, stand-up comedy, in my opinion, you know, I mean, there are people who do it differently, but what I do in stand-up comedy is just get up there, say my lines. You know, I talk from the heart, and they're jokes that I've written or they're jokes that I'm writing. Mm. And there's no mystery to it. So I like the idea of that Mamet thing, the William H. Macy.
Well, that was leads into something else I was going to ask you about, because you are a comedian, but you've also written this one woman show. So you're an actor and a writer and a stand up,
right?
And in your stand up, you pretty much do all your own material. You don't have someone else who writes for you.
No. Okay. That's you gotta have a lot of money to have somebody write for you. I do. One of my best friends is a comic, Maria Bamford, and we play a little game that we like to call Joke Machine.
Okay.
And Joke Machine is you tell the other person the joke you're working on, and the other person, there's only one rule. You have to say, there's something there, if you don't like it, right? I mean, if you can't laugh out loud, you just go, there's totally something there. Yeah. And if you can tag it, then do that. So that's really the only sort of help that I get writing. But I do, like, my brothers and my husband and everybody, I'll steal a line from them. Not from other comics, but from people.
Yes.
People walking around, those are mine.
Because they don't realize they're being funny.
Right, they don't know how funny that line is. Yeah. That's a great line. Holy crap.
But then I can see how, I see this myself, as a writer, I can see definitely the appeal of that kind of hit your mark, say your line kind of thing, because it puts all the onus on the writer. You know,
right.
The writer has to get the emotions on the page. It has to make sense, you know, the written word. It doesn't require, I'm not going to say it doesn't require as much from the actor, but it's...
If it's clear, it should be clear. And then, I mean, because I like the, it's interesting that William H. Macy would be that kind of guy because he shows a lot of emotion. I mean, he has a great range.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not like he is just saying the lines by rote, you know? He's acting.
Right.
In addition to just saying the lines. Interesting. Weird.
Yes. I'm going to jump back a little bit now and get back to your childhood experience.
Excellent.
Because I am curious about this. Now, you say that you and the community put up plays, or were they done through school?
No, it was just neighborhood.
Oh, so just in, Little Rascals. We'll put up a show in the bar?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, Little Rascals. And we did it in Michael Harriman's garage. And
so these would be all original productions.
All original productions. Yep. Well, what happened was Andy Savajan, who I believe goes by Drew these days, Andrew.
Oh, okay. That's why. All right.
That's why you don't know. And works for the DNR in Wisconsin. Now, anyway, he was the coolest kid in the neighborhood. But for 2 weeks every summer, he would go to basketball camp. So when he was there, we would play basketball. We would play football. He would he essentially taught us how to make snow forts, and we would have teams and play war. And we would, you know, we were his gang, essentially. But for 2 weeks in the summer, he was gone.
There was a power vacuum.
There was a power vacuum, and someone had to reach in and do something about it. And so my sister had sort of come out of the woodwork, because she didn't, you know, she was even a little bit older than Andy. And so, Andy Savajan, so they didn't really hang out. And then, yeah, so it would be like the Harrimans, like Michael and Michelle Harriman, and then myself, and then Chad Steinle, and then Annie, Chris, and Nikki were the Shablowskis. They lived across the street. And we would just sort of put together a show.
Okay.
And we would just, like, write little sketches, and there would be songs and music, and our parents would stop by, or somebody's parents would stop by. I don't even know who it was. And then some other kids from, like, a block over would stop by. It was a very bucolic little suburban moment.
Yeah. Kind of an ongoing cabaret.
Yeah, yeah, recurring more. Yeah. It was summer stock, but only for 2 weeks. There'd be one show every summer, essentially, until junior high. And that probably lasted 3 or 4 summers.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that was probably very freeing without any kind of, like, you know, strict supervision or...
There was a lot of pressure, though.
Oh, really?
There was a lot of pressure just because... you know how kids are. Kids are super judgmental. So if you come up with an idea that nobody likes, they're not going to pull their punches. They're going to be like, well, that's dumb.
Yeah.
And so it was that. And I can't remember. I remember one time, the one that I remember is my sister played a mobster called Big Louie. And there was a gang. And it was sort of a mob kind of mafia thing, you know.
Yeah.
So, but she also, there was music. And because I played the clarinet, and I think Michael Harriman played, what did he play, tenor sax? Mm-hmm. I forget what he played. Anyway, but yeah, so there'd be music, and there'd be, and I think Michelle Harriman always wanted to dance.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of an American Girl kind of kid.
Yeah.
So she always wanted to dance, and always wanted there to be a nice costume.
Okay, yeah.
Very lovely. And it was you know, it was what it was. It was fun.
So how old were you when you started with the clarinet?
I was 8.
8? Wow.
I think. Third
gotcha.
Grade?
Young, yeah.
Yeah, second grade. My parents, it was the thing that they... It was funny that my parents insisted we all take instruments. And when you think about it, beginning violin, you've really committed to listening to some really horrible sounds coming out of your kid's bedroom. And I took... Darla took violin, and I took viola. And after about 6 months of viola... And Michael Harriman had taken viola, too, or violin, and we both quit together. And I went home and told my parents that I quit. And Darla, my sister, was like, you can quit? I didn't know you could quit. And my parents said, you can't really. You have to take a wind instrument then. Huh. And I was like, so I took the clarinet.
Right.
Yeah.
So then you did marching band and whatever.
Right. Well, I took the clarinet until junior high, and then they switched. I was not a good clarinet player. I was never a very good musician. My sister was a really good musician because she didn't know you could quit.
Mm-hmm.
So in her fury, she practiced like 4 hours a day until she got really good, and then she liked it.
Okay.
So, and then when I took clarinet, she started playing my clarinet.
Uh-huh.
And then she also played French horn and trombone. And then when I went to high school, I started playing trumpet. And she took trumpet and then viola. Anyway, so she's really good at music. I played the clarinet until marching band when I played the trumpet in marching band.
Now, since you were in marching band, did you get roped into playing band for the musicals?
Yeah, yeah. I was in the Pitt Orchestra.
Pitt Orchestra, there you go.
Although at our at South Milwaukee High, Go Rockets, it was the Floor Orchestra.
Yeah. Same thing at my high school.
Excellent. What did you play?
Well, I was not... I had quit the trumpet.
Oh, okay.
I started trumpet in third grade. I quit at the end of eighth grade. Because going into high school, the way the arts programs worked... You pretty much had the choice. You could either do music or you could do art. And
oh,
I wanted
really?
To do art. And I had a couple of bad experiences with music teachers.
Okay, fair enough. Because so, I didn't like my junior high music teacher at all. Mm-hmm. And my sister said, stick it out to high school because the high school teacher is amazing. And so, and that was true because the grade school teacher was a lame ass. Mm-hmm. And his sister taught the high school. Mr. Owie, grade school. Miss Owie, high school. And then in the middle, sort of some scatter showers. Yeah. I don't know. But not that fun.
Right.
It was all a concert. So.
Exactly. Did you ever get into, like, you know, jazz trumpet or swing?
No, I was never good enough.
No?
I was never good enough to be in, like, the jazz band. Mm. They got to wear some snazzy shirts, though. And, but I had two friends. My two friends in high school were they were both drummers.
You had more than two friends, I hope.
No, I think pretty much two friends.
Oh.
I was alone. That's why I do stand-up comedy.
Oh, okay.
Anyway. And, there were, essentially, I mean, there were people I knew, and, but I wasn't really, and literally, I keep in touch with one guy from high school.
Wow.
One of the drumming guys. And everybody else I know from high school, Facebook, and I can't remember them. And, but there were some really, like, there were some people in, like, I was in debate. And I was in, I was on the something called forensics, which is a spoken word kind of thing as well. I did a lot of spoken word stuff, and I was in student council, and then I was in, worked at the school newspaper, and so there was a lot of that kind of thing.
A lot of writing and presentational stuff.
Well, yeah, a lot of writing, and because I wasn't, there was no choices. My parents told me I was going to be doing music, and my sister told me I was going to be in debate, and she would constantly volunteer me for things like. One year I had to stuff envelopes for the John Anderson campaign. That would be 1980, when many of your listeners were not born yet.
Anderson? Was he challenging Carter?
It was a third party.
Oh, okay. Huh.
And it was, he siphoned off a lot of the Carter votes, yeah. Much a la Nader.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but my sister was constantly volunteering me for things. And
now, so then you were in high school. How much older was your sister?
Year and a half.
Oh,
so
okay.
She was just, like, I was a sophomore and she was a senior. So,
I got it.
Yeah.
Both of my sisters were out of high school by the time I got there. So.
Oh, okay.
But,
yeah.
I, you know, they had left a reputation.
Of course, in their wake.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then my, and then each of my brothers is only, like, a year and a half older. Mm. So, like, when my sister was a sophomore, my brother Russ was a senior. And so it was like that.
I see. Well, yeah, I went to a Catholic high school, so there was a very similar sort of situation. If
right.
If there was, like, one Gibbons, there was probably three or four more
right.
behind them. Yeah. So I was the last of the Amiots to go through.
I was going
to
say, it was like, you're Jimmy Amiot's little brother?
Yeah.
And,
well, again, I only had older sisters, so I didn't
Oh, you
have
only
to
have
there.
Older
yeah.
sisters? Oh, that is nice.
Yeah, but they were. It was very similar to what you were describing, where they were a lot more accomplished than me, both academically and athletically.
Ugh.
You know, I was the artistic one. I was the one who liked
right.
performing. So, you know, there were certain expectations, which I'd like to think I broke them pretty quickly.
Right. You're like, lower the bar,
yeah,
lower the
exactly.
bar. It'll be fine.
Yeah. But I'll talk in class and I'll participate. So that's what you get.
Give me a blue book.
Yeah.
It'll all work out.
So then, do you remember which musicals you played trumpet for in the band?
Flower Drum Song.
Flower
and,
drum song.
Oh, I was bass clarinet. In concert band, I was still bass clarinet,
oh,
but only
okay.
in marching band did I go trumpet. Because bass clarinet's not going to march.
Right.
How are you
going to
march that? And so...
Strumpet, you had a little clip there with the sheet music that's right at eye level. Did you
yep,
have that? Or?
Yep. And so... And it's funny about marching band is that the marching band has an alumni reunion. And it's the only reunion I ever went to, the 5-year. And... When I heard the marching band cadence, like the drummers do the cadence that we would march to for most of the parades, and then there were a couple of songs that we played every time, Macarena and Barcelona, or whatever it was called. There were two kind of Spanish-themed, and when the cadence started, I literally laughed so hard I cried,
yeah.
just because of the memories of... Because marching band is not cool
no.
in high school, but there were cool kids in marching band, and... It was, you know, it was the best you could do, right? And so I wasn't even a cool kid in marching band, but I had more friends there than out of marching band. So it made me laugh and just, it was a nice memory. I did love marching band in
yeah.
high school.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. All right. So, we'll get back then to stand up.
Please.
Now, you got started as a local comic in Wisconsin and then again in Minnesota.
Right.
What prompted your move to California?
Well, in 1996, I did the second year of what was then called the HBO Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, I mean, it's whatever. In my opinion, this is how people move to Los Angeles. Somebody says, you're great. It's going to be a piece of cake for you. Move to Los Angeles. And luckily, I had had enough friends who had moved here who said, you can move here. But what you're doing is you're running it up the flagpole to see if anybody gives a shit. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And there's nothing you can do about it. So, but it depends what you want to do. If you want to be on television and you want to act and do that kind of thing, you should come to L.A. or New York. And I had tried to move to New York and in 88, 89. I was going to move to New York and do stand-up. But New York in 88, 89, it was all bringers. It was so expensive. And because L.A. has a version of a blue-collar neighborhood, which is where we live. You know, you live in Northridge, I live in Van Nuys. You can live a relatively decent lifestyle, you know? And you don't have to... Like, to live in New York, I would have been in a closet.
Yeah.
And standing up, asleep.
And with a roommate.
With a roommate. And it would have been horrible. And so I couldn't take it.
Yeah.
And so I lived there for about 3 or 4 months. I got a day job at the worst place I've ever worked in my life, which was it's an insurance company called Chubb Life.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're big supporters of public television, aren't they?
They might be. Yeah. And they were not terrible people. But it was a terrible job, and I didn't get it. I didn't want to get it, and my boss was this woman who was drunk at her desk.
Oh, no.
Almost. She would show up around noon, pass out on her desk, and I worked there 1 week, and then I went to the boss, and I said, yeah, I have to go back to Wisconsin. My mom got cancer. And he was like, what? He so didn't believe me. He said, how about you go back to Wisconsin? And you come, I'll give you 2 weeks and I'll give it to you paid if you come back. Because he couldn't keep an assistant for this woman. This woman, I went to one meeting with her. She was super together looking, except for she was not together at all. And at the one meeting we went together where I saw her standing, because other than that, she was just sitting at her desk, passed out or awake, not telling me what to do. And the one time I saw her walk, she had nylons on with a giant hole in the back. And I looked at one of the other women from the stenography pool or secretary pool or wherever the hell I was sitting, and she went, yeah, there's nothing to be done about her. And I was like, I'll tell you what I can do about her, not work for her. So I tried to move to New York, and then I came back home, and I lived with my sister for 3 months. And then a friend of mine was moving to Minneapolis, and my brother lived up there, and so I moved up to Minneapolis to do stand-up there. Best decision I ever made, because Minneapolis, the stand-up scene there has always been super vibrant. Right now, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Right now, it's the guy who owns the main club there is a guy named Lewis Lee, and he has been building that club for 15 years. He does an open mic that's free for 15 years, every Monday night, all ages. You don't have to order anything, even. And so 15 years ago, he would get 16-year-olds coming in, getting water and watching open mic. Well, 15 years later, they're 30. Mm-hmm. And they come 2 or 3 times a month. And they come every week to open mic. And they spend, and they drink, and they, you know, buy food. And they're comedy connoisseurs now. Now they know what... And the other thing Lewis does is he'll take local comics, and he'll start them in open mic, which is a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. Wherever you go, open mic is a pain in the ass, especially the sort of the hot open mic. You'll usually get up once a month if you're lucky, but you got to find somewhere else to go up. And so, but if you do well, he'll move you to MC. He'll work you enough that he'll move you to feature. He's moved more people up from MC to headliner. And a lot of clubs won't do it. They'll be like, oh, you're a local. I can feature you forever and treat you poorly. Right. He's literally the best guy in stand-up comedy today. The best club owner.
Shoot, I'm in the wrong city.
Well, if you want, did you start doing stand-up here?
No, a little bit here. Up in the Bay Area.
In the Bay Area?
Yeah.
Which is a great place to do stand-up just because of how much stage time you can get.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the key to doing stand-up comedy, is to perform in front of four other comics, to perform in front of the career drunks at the bar, to perform in front of those different four comics. I mean, to try to get up 5-6 times a week is ideal.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 40. I want to fall asleep now. I don't know if I could move again, you know? Because when you move, you have to reinvent the wheel to some extent. You have to prove that you're funny again. I know a lot of comics who move to L.A., and they're mad because they're very popular on the road or in their hometown. Everybody knows who they are. They're a big fish in a small pond, and that's why they came here. Well, you just have to prove it again. And if you are good, you'll move that much faster.
Right.
So it shouldn't be that big of a deal, but it is an ego blow. Some comics can't take it.
Right.
Like, they move here and they're like, I'm not doing that open mic. And I'm like, a comedy death ray at the UCB is not an open mic. You call it an open mic because it doesn't pay anything. And
wait. Let me see if I got this right. You have people who are turning down the opportunity to be on Comedy Death Row.
No, that's the extreme example.
Okay, I was going to say.
Yeah, it's the extreme. That's the extreme example.
Okay.
But someone who said, "Oh, I don't want to do Tiger Lily,"
right?
Or I don't want to do that Holy Fuck show, or I wouldn't want to do, you know, there's a dozen really great shows that have 20 to 200 people that show up at them, and you're like, well, I want to do those shows. I'm doing an open mic tomorrow night that Jake Kroger guy runs because he said I could have 15 minutes at an open mic. And I'm like, good, because expectations are super low and I am going to work on every weird bit that I've never, you know. Because usually the open mic I usually go to when I go to open mic in L.A. is the Westwood Brew Co.
Okay.
Down in Westwood. And that guy's been running it forever, but he does... I get a, because I've known him forever, because I've known him for 10 years, I don't have to sign up, but he doesn't give me any more time.
Right.
I only get 3 to 5 minutes, just like everybody else, which, you know, it's a treat to not have to sign up and take the crapshoot, but 3 to 5 minutes, I could be a jackass and go, well, how am I supposed to work on anything?
Yeah.
Well, 3 to 5 minutes is 3 to 5 minutes. If I really want to work on something, I will go there and do the one bit I want to work on. And because it's all ego.
Yeah.
It's all ridiculous.
Well, that's one of the things that I find appealing about your persona, and it's both, you know, on stage and off, is that I don't see a whole lot of ego at work in gentrification.
Oh, I'm hiding it.
Oh, really? You have a story?
Well, I am, there's so much that I want out of this industry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want to be... It's a gift to be respected, you know? And I feel like I am. And that people... And it's... The things that I am good at, I am acknowledged for them. Mm-hmm. But I'm not acknowledged for them at the level to which I would like to be acknowledged for them. It is lovely to be appreciated by my peers... And I swear to God, I mean, it's really nice that when I see somebody, they're like, oh, it's you. You are known to me to not be a jackass and a genuinely funny person.
Right.
Which, what Matt Weinhold introduced me to his wife and said, this is Jackie Cation. She's really funny and she's really nice. And the woman turned to me and Carrie, very nice woman, and she goes, you realize he's never said those two things to me together. He'll either introduce a comic as this guy's really funny or he's really nice. So.
Oh, boy.
It's.
Oh, geez. I'm just remembering a time that I was at a show and the MC introduced me. Our next comic coming up is a really smart guy. Here he is, Dave.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch. That's, I mean, my favorite thing when I came on stage one time was, and I had not had a good set. But it wasn't that bad. Well, it was bad. Anyway, whatever. Obviously, this gentleman, the nicest thing he could say to me was, well, you were up there. I was like, yep. Yeah, I was.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I'm a big podcasting nerd.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Most of the podcasts that I listen to are comedy-based. They're either about comedy or they're about, like, comic books.
Okay.
So, you know, all the comedy podcasts that I listen to, you know, Never Not Funny, WTF, Scarborough Country. Whenever your name comes up, it's like, oh yeah, Jackie Cation. I love her. She's great.
Okay, so, well, that's great. Yeah. Well, Scar, I think the Sklar Brothers, that their comedy podcast, don't they do a lot of sports talk?
Yeah.
Is it?
But it's accessible.
Is it?
Yeah. I'm not a sports nerd.
Right.
It's sort of like the TV show Sports Night, where you don't have to be a sports fan to appreciate it.
Oh, that old sitcom? That was great. That was a great sitcom.
And it's sort of like they did Cheap Seats. And Cheap Seats was fun to watch, even though I didn't know very much about sports at all. So.
Right, right.
Yeah, and they do, you know, they do sketches, and they have on guests.
Oh, do they do sketches?
Well, they have...
I hear CDR's podcast does sketches.
It's sort of like CDR, where they'll have someone come on as a character.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, the sketch will be about that.
Right.
That character, so.
Yeah,
Well, this is going very well.
Okay.
I don't have a time limit unless you have somewhere to be.
No. Is it really that?
It's, it's nearly 3 o'clock.
So we've been recording for 2 hours?
No.
Hour and a half, right?
Yeah, we're at 51 minutes.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, so I guess now comes the time where I would ask you for, like, an interesting... You talk about how when you went to go see Sam Kinison,
right,
you were the stereotypical nightmare audience member.
Mm.
Young, drunk, woman, rowdy... But I also...
Illegible. unintelligible. Illegible.
Have you ever... I guess since you started comedy so early, there never would have been an occasion where you would have been in a comedy club and felt like you had the right to heckle somebody or give someone a hard time. Have you ever done that?
Oh, I've done some... sometimes... Because, you know, the best thing for comics is just... That's why we all stay in the back.
Mm-hmm.
You got to stay in the back because the thing is you want to heckle. You want to have a running commentary, so you have to do it with another comic. And so it isn't loud enough that it doesn't interrupt somebody's set.
Mm.
And it doesn't actually affect. But I've actually had heckle situations that have been pulled out of me at open mic situations.
Mm-hmm.
Where, and it's not, it still isn't okay. Still, go to the back of the room, bitch to your friend about something that you're like, that's an interesting choice on their part.
Yeah.
And... Because, and especially an open mic, where literally you should get to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's horrifying, it's an open mic, and you were looking for the funny and failing.
Right.
Which is where you get to fail at an open mic. And, I think it was just something so incredibly misogynist. That I just was like, are you kidding me? I mean, it wasn't anything that bad. It was just me pulled out of me to go, what is happening?
Yeah.
So I did. So yeah, no, I don't, I don't heckle.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I did once, it was a similar situation to you. I was in college, some friends had won free tickets to a comedy show, so we went. I wasn't liking the guy's act.
Right.
He did something and I yelled at him and there was a little back and forth, but it was...
I just met a guy.
I regret it now.
I was just in Texas for New Year's and in Austin. Guy came up to me after the show. He had seen me in 1988 do an open mic.
Wow.
And he said, "Did you used to do a joke?" And he quoted a joke that I used to do. And in the first, you know, and in the first 4 years of stand-up comedy, there aren't that many jokes that are memorable. But it was a pretty good joke because I did it. I think I did that joke well into the 90s, so it wasn't a bad joke. It was just about, I'm from a little town in Wisconsin called South Milwaukee, and I think the line was something like, where bowling is more than just a word, it's a way of life. And, yeah, so it's just a, huh,
yeah.
Okay, that's something. And it was fine, but, you know, in the first 4 years, you win, and... So, but he was like, "Did you used to do a joke about that?" And then I would tell a story about how I took a class in high school called biking and bowling. And I thought it would be like polo. And I genuinely did for a minute, where it would be like polo, where you would bowl from the bike. But no, it was bike to the bowling alley, bowl, bike back to school. Anyway, so that was the only joke in it. And, but he said, "I think I saw you at the student union," because after the comedy club burned down, in 87, I think it was, I did open mic probably 5 or 15 times a year. And one of the places that had open mic was the student union, a little room off to the side. So,
I'm interested about the place in Minnesota.
Acme.
Acme, where that was, where you say that the guy, Lou?
Lewis, yeah.
Is very good at cultivating both comedians and an audience, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So the people that show up for the open mics are comedy fans.
Yeah.
And they're there because they want to see, like, developing comics? And they,
yeah.
Oh, okay. So that sounds like a really savvy crowd.
Yeah, super savvy. And so the audiences, for the rest of the week, you know, it can be full of some people, you know, especially at holiday times. Mm-hmm. Man, this had to be 4 years ago now, and I am going, he's headlining me. He'll headline me once a year, and then he'll feature me twice a year so that I can visit my brother and sister who live in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And, or I'll do a split week with somebody. And it's where a split week being I would headline the Wednesday, Thursday, and they would come in and headline, like the bigger name would come in and headline Friday, Saturday. Mm-hmm. Like Maria Bamford or Dana Gould or, I don't know, somebody else. So, but he had me headline for the first time at a Christmas week. Like it was in December 4 years ago, and I headlined, and Chad Daniels was featuring, and he's a headliner. He's a half hour special at Comedy Central. He's from Minnesota though. And, thing about Chad is Chad can get really mad at the audience if something isn't going perfectly, whatever. And so he gets off stage and he's all mad at them. And I forget about it that he can tend to react in this fashion. So I go on stage and I'm like, oh, they're going to be talking. And I'm all in my head already. And so this guy in the fourth row talks. And I'm like, no. In the first 5 minutes of my 45-minute set, I was like, you gotta leave. He was attached to 58 other people.
Oh.
He was like the head of the corporation for this Christmas party. And so, Lewis backed me up. And
when you say he talked, was he like just talking to someone else at the table or was he talking at you?
No, me, just randomly shouting crap at me. And he did it like 2 or 3 times in the course of a minute.
Huh.
And I was like, well, I'm not gonna work like this. And so I kicked him out. And he was attached to so many people in the first 5 minutes of my set. And then I had to do another 40 minutes.
So did the other people walk or did they?
Oh, they all left. Oh. But there were 200 people sitting there after the 58 left. And I was like, well, this is awkward. How's it going out there? And I had to finish my show because you always have to do your time.
Oh, yeah.
And so I get off stage. And so the weekends, it's fine. The rest of the week is fine. And I call for work the following Christmas. And Lou goes, I think I get you in around March or April. And I was like, well, I was hoping to visit my family and do Christmas. What do you? And he's like, yeah, I think I'll have something for you in March, Jesse. And so I hang up, and then I realize why.
Yeah.
And I call him back, and I was like, Lewis, no, seriously, I'll eat it, I'll take it. It won't matter, I'll just, and he's like, no, it doesn't have anything to do with that, it'll be fine, but I think March. And so every year, and this is the closest I've come, first week of February, and I think it was like the beginning of November 1 year, and then the first week of February this year, is the closest I've come to anywhere near the holiday. But he will feature me at Christmas now. Like last year he featured me and I, Bryant, a singer, black lady, crooner, awesome. Mm-hmm. Not Anita Bryant, she's the George Juice right wing nutbag. But
it's going to drive me nuts.
That's going to the notes.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so I featured for her.
Oh.
And I just opened for her at a theater event. So what he'll do is he'll feature me at Christmas and then get me a private, like a corporate or something like that.
Cool.
So it's not that he doesn't believe in me.
Right,
just he's like, yeah, I'm going to get someone a little safer. Chad Daniels has done Christmas.
Well, then where else do you look forward to performing? Like where do you find like consistently the really good crowds, the really receptive audiences?
San Francisco is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
There's that Tuesday night in Throckmorton in Mill Valley.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah, it's run by a comic named Mark Pitta. And
I know Mark Pitta.
Well, he runs a Tuesday, and the weird thing is Robin Williams, Dana Carvey, I think. He's never showed up when I'm there, and Mort Saul all live in Mill Valley, so they stop down on any given Tuesday just to do sets.
Mm.
And it's awesome. So it's sold out. The audience is predominantly like fabulously wealthy, left-leaning white people.
Okay.
And, you know, like Mill Valley, California, by the way, is like if a tiny town in Connecticut had been lifted up and transplanted. It's like, it looks like the set of the Gilmore Girls is what it looks like, but okay. In a summer kind of situation. And the only people with any sort of melanin that I saw there had been adopted. There were a lot of white folk, but they're super nice and they have their hearts in the right place. Right. That's nice. And so that's a great place. There's a lot of really great clubs. I've only done it once. During school year, Bloomington, Indiana has a new club that I'm really liking. New York is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, the clubs in New York are always fun. Princeton, New Jersey used to have it still does. It's just a weekend room, a Catch a Rising Star at a Hilton. But I never realized what a great room it was until I did Atlantic City, New Jersey. That's a different experience because Princeton, New Jersey, even the townies are smart. Atlantic City, New Jersey... It's a freaking nightmare. It is like Jersey Shore, horrible. It's a bad idea.
Yeah.
And the best thing about Atlantic City, New Jersey, is they have a really good sandwich. They do a really nice work with a cold cut sandwich there. You get a chance. The White House, of course, is the famous place that has them. But even any place on the boardwalk, get yourself an Italian sub.
Lots of opportunities to eat fresh.
But that's that you can eat fresh, but. A lot more meat than at the Subway.
Very good.
Full circle. Nice one.
Oh, hey, you know. I did a lot of improv and, you know, doing callbacks. It's one of those things that they encourage.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, then, I don't like to ask questions about negative experiences, but I do find that they're often the more formative ones.
Mm.
So, you know, where have you gone? Is there a place that sticks out in your mind? I think you've mentioned a place like in North Dakota that's the worst...
The worst gig ever. You know, I continue to do that joke, even though Atlantic City has indeed taken a front seat to North Platte, Nebraska. North Platte, Nebraska, the gig is bad. The joke is still funny about the bad experience that it was. But Atlantic City was the worst. It's literally, they're so old, and they're so dumb, and they're so gambly.
Mm.
And they're so not there for stand-up comedy that, and the booking around me, like everybody was doing 20 minutes. And the comic before me, the comic after me, played Atlantic City all the time. So they knew to curse a lot, talk really fast, and not go anywhere super smart. And I don't go anywhere super smart. I might go some obscure places a little bit, but...
You do have a joke that includes a reference to The Handmaid's Tale. So.
Right. Well, and if you... I mean, if you get cable, you should be fine. You should get... I mean, if you have access to some sort of tall 26 letters, it should be fine.
Right.
I did do a show in Puerto Rico.
Oh, really?
For the Coast Guard about 6 weeks ago. And, half of the audience were adults and half were children between the ages of 6 and 14.
Oh.
And that was brutal and hilarious because there was like a row of 9 to 12-year-old boys sitting in the front row, like cross-legged, just sitting just on the ground in front of the stage, heckling every single one of us. And the guy who booked it was like, you're gonna close this night. And I was like, am I going to close this show? This is the show you want me to, not tomorrow night when it's all adults and we can swear. Fair enough. Okay. So I go up and I'm doing okay. Because I have some video game jokes and I have, you know, some parents are mean to their kid jokes. And, you know, I'm the golden retriever of stand-up comedy. I'm very likable.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing pretty good. But there's a slow spot, like there is sometimes. Mm-hmm. And like a 9, 10-year-old kid in the front row yells, I'd watch anything that you weren't in.
Ugh.
And I was like, wow, good for me that I don't get a lot of my self-esteem from children. Why don't you crawl underneath that table over there? And he did, because he's 9, and he thinks it's funny. So he crawls underneath this, you know, there's a tablecloth over it, and he climbs under this table. And one of his other little boyfriends, you know, climbs under there with him. And I go, yeah, there's nothing gay about that. Because I'm super mature.
Oh, That's cool.
It all goes south.
Yeah.
Once you're like, you want to play? We're going to play,
10-year-old. Oh, man.
I will take you down.
Have you gotten to play Helium in Portland yet?
Yeah. I featured for Maria once.
Oh, okay.
That club is interesting because the same guy, Rich Miller, Dennis Miller's brother, Jimmy Miller's brother, Rich Miller, I'm sure he loves to be described in those terms, he books that one. He books the Helium of Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
And he books the Austin, Texas, Cap City Comedy Club, which he's part owner of. And I just did that Cap City for New Year's Eve. I did a split week with Maria for New Year's, where I headlined the Wednesday, Thursday, and then she came in for New Year's Eve and the day after New Year's Eve. And I featured
which
for
would, if I'm thinking
Friday,
correctly,
Saturday.
That'd be New Year's Day?
New Year's Day. There you go. The day after New Year's Eve. Which, comedy-wise, doesn't get its own name.
Yeah.
No, it's New Year's Day. And
sorry,
yeah,
I can
Saturday.
Never silence my inner pedant sometimes. So.
Well, good for you.
I once corrected a guy on an internet forum. He was talking about Doctor Strange.
Yes.
And how he was not the first Sorcerer Supreme, and how all these Sorcerer Supremes before him did this and that. And I wrote back, you know, forgive me, but shouldn't it be Sorcerers Supreme? Much like Attorneys General.
Passers-by.
Exactly, so.
Yeah. All right, grammar school marm.
Sorry.
And no worries. I wish I was good at it. I would be the most snarky. I'd be all over it going, you know, the comma. It's a breath mark. Use it right. No. Anyway, so he books all three of those clubs. I've played now all three of those clubs. Though Helium's brand new, the Portland one, and I only got to feature it. But I would love to. Yeah, they're all. Because the thing about the Philly club is that they opened up, Lewis helped them open it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sort of gave them his business model. He was like, this is what happens, you're not going to win. You know, you don't make any money for 3 years, so sad, too bad. But go in knowing it, and then don't sell out. You know, don't book jugglers and hypnotists. And I mean, you can. Mm-hmm. You can book them at Christmas, because who doesn't love a hypnotist at Christmas or
right.
whatever? You can book a freak show. I'm not above, you know, and I've done more lady freak shows than you can shake a stick at. Because take a Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm.
I will often get a call from a particularly annoying booker, like 2 days before Valentine's Day. Hey, are you working Valentine's Day? I'm like, yeah, I'm a woman comic. All women comics are working on Valentine's Day. Because love is in the air, and they think for some reason it's okay to have a woman headliner.
Right.
So, but I really, I like the Philly room. Because they were building it nicely. And I think it's like 5 or 6 years old now. And then the Portland room, it's Portland. So it's going to be awesome.
Because
those hippie Doc Martin wearing groovers are going to get everything. And they're going to want to.
Right.
And so, and then Austin was great. Austin, Texas. It's the best. It's the best part of Texas. I'm sorry, those who live other places in Texas. But Austin tends to lend itself to a little more liberal, but it can laugh at itself for being as liberal as it is, and it's not that liberal.
Right.
So it's got a nice sense of moderation that the rest of Texas might want to look into, because the rest of Texas thinks that Austin is full of hippie freaks, and the rest of the country is like, well, it's kind of like Illinois.
Yeah.
It's not that.
So how was doing a New Year's Eve show? I've heard the New Year's Eve can be rough.
Yeah, they're always... I usually don't do them. I did them every year for years, and then I stopped doing them because they aren't comedy nerds. Comedy nerds don't come out on New Year's Eve. Or if they do, they go to a very specific show. If it's at a club, a regular club like Austin, most half of the audience or more is just going to be people like, let's go out on a New Year's Eve.
Right.
Where will we go? Will it be Bill Ingvall? Will it be Maria Bamford? I wonder what the difference is.
Mm.
It turns out it's different.
Yeah.
So they were not, they were great, but they weren't, they weren't as great as people who are comedy nerds, you know? Because it took them a second to get used to Maria, because they're like, what is she doing? Oh, she's doing voices. These are characters. Okay, and you know.
Do they recognize her from the Target ads?
Yeah, a lot of them came out just from the Target ads.
Oh, okay.
And then were mad that she wasn't just doing the Target ads. And I was like, well, you were lucky, because 45 minutes of that Target ad would make you want to cut yourself.
Exactly.
So don't be ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Thank you so much for taking the time. Where are you going to be? Where can people see you or hear
you? Well, this weekend I'm in Idaho, in Sun Valley, Idaho, where very, very fancy people go skiing.
So that would be January 7th and 8th?
I think it's 10 and 11.
10 and 11, okay.
Whatever it is. You can go to jackiecation.com and look at my calendar, and just had the website redone, which is exciting.
Okay.
And then I got my cartoon. I got one of my jokes animated, and
yes,
that's on the front page. The guy who animated it is a genius.
Yeah, it's terrific.
Yeah, and the joke is very funny.
Yeah, it's a very good joke. Very
and
well
and so all good there. And then so I'm in Idaho this weekend, and then I come home, and then I go out to Wise Guys in Trolley Square in Salt Lake City.
Ah, my sister lives in Salt Lake City.
Oh, there you go.
For her.
Oh, please.
And Beth, if you're listening to this, go see Jackie.
Beth, why aren't you listening to this? And and then the following week, I'm here. I'm doing a lot of shows in L.A. And then the week after that, is the first week of February, and I'm in Minneapolis.
Oh, that'll be nice.
That'll be very nice.
And, of course, you also have your own podcast.
Dork Forest. Not dark. Dork.
Dork.
As in nerds and geeks and whatever.
First podcast that I was ever on, and I thank you.
Oh, no problem.
You're one of the driving forces between me starting to do this.
Excellent. Let's clog up the airwaves,
exactly.
You and me. High five it.
Yeah. People don't need all that bandwidth floating around. Yeah, it was you and Paul F. Tompkins were my inspiration. So,
good. He's got, and I have, there's 213 old episodes, and then I got 14 new episodes where I pre-record, and the audio is all sweet.
Yes, I have noticed that.
And I have an intro music and everything.
Yeah, it's pretty classy, folks.
Yeah,
if you haven't been listening to the Dork Forest, you know, you're missing out.
You're missing out. You might want to cherry pick those 213 episodes just because the audio's, it's a conference call.
Well, that's true. But more often than not, the conversation makes it worthwhile.
True that.
Yeah.
That is true.
So that's Jackie Cation, K-A-S-H-I-A-N.
That's it.
.com.
Right. And Dork Forest, D-O-R-K, Forest.
And that's on iTunes.
And it's on iTunes, and there's an iPhone app, and there's an Android app, and there's a free app for Palms and Blackberries and iPhones and Androids on Stitcher.
Yeah.
And, or you can just have your computer on and press play.
There you go.
On my website.
And you don't just record by talking into your iPod. You actually have equipment now.
I said I would do a better job if they gave me donations, and then they gave me donations, and then I had to learn how to use some software.
Yeah. Double-edged sword.
So.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jackie, and thank you all for listening, and we will get you next time on the Benny South Street Chronicles.